Hello and welcome to the Energy Gang at the DistribuTech conference in Orlando. I'm Ed Crooks. We've spent a couple of days at this event, which is the leading conference for the electricity transmission and distribution industry in North America. You may have heard our earlier podcasts from the event, which we published last week. And for this last episode from the conference, I've been talking to people about how power grids need to change in response to the growth of renewable energy and what that means for the decarbonisation of the electricity system. To discuss that question, I spoke first to Ali Apakci, who's an Executive Vice President and Chief Visionary Officer at OATI, which is a grid technology company. Ali, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So, it's a fascinating event, clearly, DistribuTech. We've had really amazing conversations with people while we've been here. Tremendous sense of activity and excitement about the industry. Tremendous amount of change going on. But the question I had as I talk to people and look around is how much is really changing? And clearly this is an event which is very much dominated by technology vendors. Everyone's coming up with kind of clever ideas for doing this and that, for fixing some of the challenges that the electricity system and the grid in particular are facing. If you look back 10 years, I was looking at an article where you were quoted from 10 years ago, DistribuTech, I think in 2014, a lot of the same issues were being talked about. People were talking about distributed energy resources, people were talking about the effect of EVs, people were talking about demand-side response and so on. And it made me wonder how much has really changed in that decade, that the key topics of conversation still seem to be very similar. What has really changed in the industry? What's really different now?
Well, in my mind, there has been a significant change. 10 years ago, there were a lot of discussions, a lot of talks, a lot of visionary statements that where things going, what the potential going be, what the capabilities might be, etc. Now things are happening. Things are going in the field. Folks are relying on these capabilities. Folks are feeling the pain of and the issues associated with it and demanding robustness, demanding scalability, demanding performance. And as a result, a lot of the details of the capabilities that were envisioned 10 years ago are becoming forefront of the needs of the industry. And as you peel the onion, a lot of issues pops up that when you just kind of looking at the potential, you would not recognize those issues. So the fact that the major utilities have launched major programs to address these things and the issues they have, not necessarily, as you pointed out, perhaps technology capabilities were there 10 years ago, but organizationally, regulatory-wise, business process-wise, things were not there. The things were not deployed. Now utilities looking at how do I adjust my organization, how do I adjust my business process, how do I apply the technology and integrate technology with my business, how I train my people on how I change my overall business structure to adopt this thing. And when I was talking about peeling the onion, many of these issues also translates to some technology deployments. And I can give you some examples of it, which is kind of shows how things are evolving and how things are moving forward.
Give me some examples then, because I think that'll help make it concrete for people.
One example of it that highlights the kind of some of these issues. We have all talked about leveraging flexibilities available on demand side resources. And various different entities have popped up, such as aggregators, service providers, that go to customers, end-use customers, and sign them up to do things. In order to integrate those with utility operations and do that in a robust and reliable and accurate fashion, you have to coordinate enrollments and nomination and capabilities with utilities, billing systems, customer services, a lot of other. And then utilities basically saying, hey, I don't have any extra staff to manage these things. I want to have everything automated. At the same time, consumers and aggregators, everybody used to doing everything online, doing basically use portals, using screens. So as a result, the need for full automation of customer engagement with utilities and aggregators engagement with utilities and total integration with back-end systems has emerged. to fully automate end-to-end process that you just go online, you click a button, you start the process, it tells you where you are in that sequence, it approves, or if some information is missing, it informs you, etc. And so that whole integration with utilities infrastructure and automation of that whole process, one of the requirements of this whole, the vision what was 10 years ago. And there are numerous other examples along these lines that I can highlight.
So before we get onto some of those examples then, just to think about that one you've been talking about in terms of sort of automating the interface with the customer, is that something that utilities are adopting now, or again, is there something that they will be able to do?
No, certainly a lot of leading utilities are adopting that. That has become a requirement. The volume of the demand side participation significantly increased. We have customers that have in excess of 1,000 megawatts or even 1,500 megawatts of customer-owned assets that are participating. And you're talking about 1,500 megawatts. That is equivalent to a nuclear power plant. So you are not talking about small amounts. And that may involve 100,000, 200,000 customers. And at any given time, maybe 1,000 are opting out today, 1,000 joining tomorrow, etc., etc. And that requires automation, that requires validation. And furthermore, the amount of capacity, amount of capability available through those customers is not a fixed number. Changes hour by hour. But accurately forecasting how much capability is available for using for grid operations, that by itself requires a fair amount of rigor, how to forecast the battery or EV charging or other capabilities that can be controlled. That by itself is a major, major requirement that has emerged.
Has it been difficult to persuade utilities to adopt some of these technologies? I mean, the utility industry always has an impression of being very slow moving, very conservative, with good reason, because reliability, safety are very, very important, absolutely paramount for them. They have to keep the lights on and they don't want to take risks, and adopting all kinds of new technologies could create risks. And so there's always a difficult job to do to persuade them of the value of new technologies.
We are seeing several drivers. One being on the regulatory side, there has been a push to the whole issue of a non-wires alternatives that started from FERC many years back. And the whole issue of basically commissioners basically taking position, don't come to me and say you need to install a peaker unit. Why don't you use the demand side flexibility instead of peaker unit? And come back to us and show that the demand side flexibility is going more costly than building a peaker unit. And we think that leveraging demand side capability is less costly. So that's one driver. Second driver is consumer expectations. Consumers basically installing rooftop solar, buying electric vehicles, they're demanding fast chargers, they have, you know, smart thermostats and smart appliances. And when an aggregator comes and knocks on their door and says, hey, I wanna basically reduce your bill by being able to manage your thermostats and your consumption, number of folks sign up on that. And the federal government has basically opening up the door for aggregators be able to take those capabilities to the markets, the energy markets. As a result, utilities sitting in between are basically caught in the middle of that process, and they got to do something. And a number of also internally, a more progressive management and utilities see the future, and they want to basically be a leader. Some of the major utilities taking very progressive approaches, especially coming from top down, that we need to embrace certain things and move forward. So in my mind, basically genie is out of the bottle.
Right. And also coming back to something you were saying earlier, the pressures on utilities that seemed sort of theoretical 10 years ago are now much more real. If you think about the generation mix being very different, much higher proportions of variable renewables, as you say, many more consumers having EVs, having rooftop solar, having maybe a storage system at home and so on. New loads being added to the grid. We had a lot of discussion yesterday about AI data centers, chip factories creating increased load when it's been essentially flat electricity demand in the US for 15, 20 years. So is that the other thing that's really kind of,
correct.
You know, there's a sharp fork behind
correct.
You know,
I kind of looking at myself 10 years ago, you would go to a hardware store, you purchase a thermostat. Most of the thermostats were conventional thermostats. They were programmable, but the homeowner programmed it. Now, if you go to a hardware store, by large majority of thermostats are smart thermostats with a remote communication capabilities and an intelligence in the thermostats. And they are connected. They are connected to the internet. You can remotely communicate to it, etc. So there has been a significant amount of technology advancements over the past 10 years, enabling some of the things that were kind of a postulated 10 years ago that would be nice to do this, nice to do that. There are now technologies that are commonly available enabling those. So, and they are being purchased by customers, not by utilities. And so as a result, the utilities don't have to make the capital investment. They are being put there by customers, and furthermore, customers expect their utilities have things to accommodate the level of automation or building automation, home automation, or I have my EV charging capabilities, etc., utilities be on board with it. So management at utilities realize that, hey, things are changing and I need to get on board with it.
Yeah, that is very interesting in the way that those pressures are now really coming to bear on utilities. You mentioned earlier, you said apart from your example of aggregation of distributed energy resources, there are other examples of things that are really changing out there in the industry right now. What else would you point to?
The climate-related issues and the movement towards greening the generation side, towards renewable resources, the movement towards, and actually these days, the economics of deploying large-scale solar power plants basically better than economics of building conventional power plants. And as a result, a lot of developers basically getting financing because this is the most economic resource and the payback is there. So the bankers and others financing projects, large-scale renewable projects, because of its economics and paybacks. And as a result, a lot of utilities faced with a fast growth of solar and perhaps wind, but mostly solar, in their service territories. Then even justifying pairing the solar generation with battery storage is also proving somewhat economical. So there is new types of resources coming about, and the whole concept of being able to operate the grid with resources that they're fuel dependent on the weather, dependent on the sunshine, they are not as dispatchable as conventional generation and how operate the system. And the thinking is, in order to balance the variability of those generation, new types of generation, one needs to have flexibility on the load side. So you have to pair the load and the generation. You cannot just assume the load is always just demand whatever they want. You need to have pricing signals. You're going to need to have capabilities to balance the two together. So that is another driver coming in from the basically lower cost of these resources. And a part of it is because of the global demand and increasing production capacity. For example, China, the amount of solar generation panels coming out of China is such that it is lowering the cost significantly. And you're seeing that the developers, rather than building conventional generation, they are building, you know, solar farms.
Staggering, isn't it? It's amazing just how much those costs have fallen. And then, plus, of course, you've got the Inflation Reduction Act. You've got very generous tax incentives also in the US supporting that investment in solar and wind. The thing I wonder, though, about this, and the kind of the pushback you'll hear from some people, is to say these comparisons of costs on a LCOE, levelized cost of energy basis, are misleading because they'll show you how much cheaper wind and solar are, but they don't take into account whole of system costs, and they don't take into account whatever investments may be needed to strengthen the grid, put in new transmission capacity, whatever it might be, invest in the new kinds of software and management systems.
Well, I bring an angle. Others argue that cost of climate change is far, far more than if you're worried about that I need a new transmission line or upgrade my technology for managing. Cost of climate related issues, the way things are going, far, far more than the amount of severe weather conditions we are having, amount of damage and amount of expenses that associated with the impact of climate change is significant. And to avoid those, we have to go on this path. We have no other choice.
But you do have to resort to the climate argument then, you think. You can't just say to people, look, if you go down this route, cleaner energy, you will actually save money.
Well,
you have to
I think in total the cost may be higher, but I think right now there are all these studies done based on the levelized cost of energy that looking at the, basically when you say levelized, looking at the life of the generation and what is the basically cost of megawatt hour generation out of a given resource type. And for past couple of years, solar and wind are the least costly in the levelized cost, which involves basically deployment of it, delivery of it, operating of it. So the economics is there, the climate is here, the climate change is here, consumer expectation is there, and politically, you know, there are supports there. So things have lined up and the utilities have to respond to it. And that is the way we see it.
Some of those things may not be true forever. There's an election in the US in November. Composition of Congress may change. Control of the White House may change. Policy could head in a different direction. Is that going to stop these trends, do you think? Are we then going to see a reversal and a brake being put on the adoption of renewables, other forms of low carbon energy across the US?
Good question. I think it may slow it down somewhat. However, right now, because of the global costs, really, basically the cost of these type of generation is a global factor. It is not a US controlled item. You know, supply chain, as you had pointed out, the amount of production and cost of it. Furthermore, consumer expectations, and once utilities make a strategic decision in moving in certain direction, utilities don't turn on a dime. They are kind of slow movers. And once the decision is made, changing it may take several years. So we are seeing a significant change in the mindsets, and we think it's going to continue. It may slow down somewhat, but the movement is there. For example, electrification of transportation, even though in recent months purchase of EVs have somewhat gone down, but these days if you visit a auto show floor, maybe half of the cars put on the show floor are EVs. Manufacturing is changing, the factories are changing, and those things are not going to stop because of the political changes.
So we should go back, actually, and I should ask a question that I meant to ask just before. So you were talking about LCOE. As you say, on an LCOE basis, you will see that wind and solar power look like the cheapest possible forms of generation in the US if you're building new capacity. What I think a lot of people would argue is those LCOE calculations are misleading because they don't tell you about the whole of system cost of an electricity system. And I guess you could also say that a lot of the time what you're not doing is kind of building new capacity. What you're doing is retiring old capacity. If you've got an old coal-fired power plant, which is basically depreciated down to zero, that's different from building a brand new coal plant. Clearly, no one's going to build a brand new coal plant in the US, but the old ones can still run and generate power at a relatively low cost. So is it not the case, as I say, when you think about those factors?
I kind of look at data currently. In 2023, 84% of new installed capacity was renewables and storage. In the queue, the applications for interconnection of generation going forward, right now, what is queue in across the entire United States? To my surprise, and I was really surprised, 94% of it is renewables. And in other words, developers, whether it's utilities or independent developers and others, they have put their applications to build new generation. 94% of it is renewables and storage. Now, we can say, oh, levelized cost of energy is misleading and whatnot, but somehow those developers have been able to get financing, have to be able to get their business plan in a position to put application for building this generation. 94%, my jaw dropped when I saw that statistic. And that translates to that they are seeing something that they think that is where the demand is. So as a result, you know, it's a market-based thing. They see the demand, they put in the application, they get the financing, bankers see that they can get a return on their investment, they put the financing in, and it goes forward. Now, whether the levelized cost of numbers that the way DOE calculates or does things is, you know, this way or that way, I don't know.
That is a very good point, though. Yeah, it's absolutely right. So I just want to ask you about how OATI fits into this changing landscape. We're sitting here at your stand at Distributech, which has got this absolutely fantastic layout where you've got this sort of mock-up of electricity poles and sort of red LED lights on the wires flowing between them. Can you tell us what you're trying to suggest by this?
What's the message of all this layout? OATI kind of looks at the OATI started when federal government opened up the transmission access for generation 25, 30 years ago. And we have started looking at the impact of renewables, the impact of distributed resources. And we truly feel that we have capabilities that does end-to-end connection from the thermostat behind somebody's meter all the way up to the ISOs and market operation and everything in between. And we truly believe we have systems in the field, customers that are using, and we have been able to manage the information flow from individual thermostat all the way to the ISO markets and the grid operation and reliability of transmission system. And the demonstration here, even though Distributech in the past historically focused on distribution side of the business, we thought that it is important for us to demonstrate that the capabilities can be end-to-end integrated. And we put together the visuals to illustrate that end-to-end concept. And we are getting very positive feedback because a lot of values of the demand flexibility get generated when you bring them down to wholesale side of the system and then use it for grid operation. So we are demonstrating that and we are getting very positive feedback from our folks attending us or overall the industry.
Yeah, it certainly does make the point in a very, very vivid way. Well, I know you have to run, Ali Apache, so I'll let you go, but thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I raised these same issues with Don McPhail, Business Manager for Energy and Decarbonisation at Uplight, which is a software company that serves utilities working on decarbonisation. Don, thanks very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks very much, Ed. Great to be here.
So look, I wanted to start off thinking about a question that's been rumbling around a lot, I think, in the debate over energy, and is certainly very present here at Distributech, which is the question of the cost of electricity and what's happening to that. And I suppose essentially the kind of the shorthand version of this is, if renewables are so cheap, why is power getting more expensive? And the kind of the longer version of that, I suppose, is, you know, look at all these levelized cost of energy calculations that everyone has. It's very clear that wind and solar are the lowest cost forms of generation in the US. Wind and solar are increasingly being rolled out across the country for exactly that reason, because they're so competitive. And yet power prices continue to rise. And people will say, well, okay, what's going on here is that the LCOE doesn't tell you the whole story, but if you look at the whole of system cost, if you look at cost of new grid infrastructure that's needed, if you look at the increased costs of balancing the grid and so on, actually what's happening is you're driving up that whole of system cost. And so in fact, it's sort of misleading to think about the low LCOE of renewables. And actually, in fact, we are making electricity more expensive by decarbonizing it. Do you think there's anything in that critique? And if there is, what can be done about it?
Yeah, I think I would frame it a lot around the transition period that we're in that a lot of the existing generation has run a long asset life and is low cost at this point because it has been capitalized over a long period of time. So any generation being replaced had a cost to come into it. And so the low LCE makes the renewables more effective. The other part is transmission and distribution costs and the upgrades as we have increasing demand, but also renewables connecting into transmission upgrades. All of that is new asset upgrades that have to be part of it. And so it's more the transitionary period of it that is introducing new investment into the sector as opposed to the like cost. But the blip in time makes it look more like that, I would say.
Right, great point. And also, as you say, it's not just that we're trying to decarbonize the grid. We're trying to add a load, more new load, exactly, onto it, because we're decarbonizing other parts of the energy system, such as transport and electrification of transport. Everyone's getting an EV, supposedly. That's the goal in the long term. There's also, having been largely flat for 15 years now or more, electricity demand is starting to rise, apparently quite steeply. If you hear what a lot of people are talking about here in terms of new AI applications, data centers being required for that, new chip manufacturing facilities being built in the US, and a resurgence of manufacturing in general in this country, that's pushing up power demand. So you're putting all those extra demands on the grid at the same time that you're trying to decarbonize it.
Right, exactly, yeah. I think back to like 15 years ago when I first started a utility, and like a lot of the conversation was around the death spiral because there would be all this substitution with solar. And the reality is that a lot of additional loads have come on, whether it was air conditioning initially, but now like to your point around electrification of transportation, and that's all driving demand up. The opportunity though is to not have that add to poles and wires, but to connect it in a smart way at the time of adoption, have it be a flexible resource from day one to not just offset that investment, but also be able to add value to the grid as well.
Right, so that was what I was going to ask you about, really, which is, what can you do about that? Given that set of challenges, how can technology help address some of those things? And as you say, potentially avoid some of that increased cost in terms of investment in physical infrastructure that is otherwise going to be needed.
Yeah, I think that's the opportunity, is that as customers adopt these technologies, they're thinking about it, it's the first time they're getting used to using electric vehicles, adding smart thermostats, adding connected water heaters, et cetera. That's the prime time to get customers adopted into having these devices connected. And the great thing is that they bring a diversity with that load flexibility as well across the customer types and the customer categories. And so you can very easily see the value that they can provide simply at a wholesale level, but even getting into network deferral, network avoidance by just being able to control them or curtail them when there is peak constraints in that.
So is that flexibility real though? I mean, it's often talked about in theoretical terms. I always wonder if you start saying to customers, oh no, you can't actually charge your EV at the moment, or actually you're going to have to switch the air conditioning to a higher temperature now because the grid's under strain. Pretty clear people don't like that, right? Anytime that's been trialed in pilots, tends to be quite a lot of consumer pushback. So how can you kind of sell that to people? You know, technology might be ready, but the people aren't. And that's a pretty fundamental problem, isn't it?
Right, I think you're spot on. I think it's not a technology problem at this point. It's a people and even regulatory element to it. And so that's where the diversity and the like how much you expect to get out of that load flexibility. I think if you want to take approach where it's like a big red button that when I push it and everything sheds, you'll pretty quickly get people annoyed and they'll leave these type of programs. The factor is to more like account for the human elements of, I want to make sure that they're comfortable with their thermostat, so setbacks in the temperature not being too significant, but the fact that I have a population I can run across and the incremental cost of running those events is zero, then that can add a lot of value. Same with the EVs and that as well, like not everyone has to be in it, but if a car's sitting there and it doesn't need it till 6 a.m. and it's 6 p.m. at night, you know, being able to adjust those just by a couple hours can have a zero impact to the customer.
Right, so you're kind of offering people flexibility rather than mandating.
Right, exactly, yeah. And making sure that they get a fair exchange for value because they're giving up something or enabling a service to the grid as part of that.
So in terms of what you're doing at Uplight then, how are you working on this and what kind of solutions are you offering?
Yeah, so we do everything from the customer education and customer engagement piece to make them primed for increasing their propensity to take into these programs, being able to enable them with the technology. So we do e-commerce marketplaces for utilities to help them adopt the smart technologies and at the point of sale be pre-authorized to be. So as soon as they're connected to Wi-Fi, they're a dispatchable resource, which overcomes a whole heap of the acquisition challenges. But then bringing all those resources through into the Uplight AutoGrid Flex DERMS to essentially make all of those assets controllable and dispatchable alongside CNI resources, alongside behavioral resources, or even alongside front of the meter resources as well.
And DERMS probably is an acronym that we should agree to. That's Distributed Energy Resource Management System, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And what does that mean exactly?
In this case, it's the software that's enabling the control of those devices in a fleet sense. And stopping at the software would be, you know, sort of selling it short. To go to the extra step of the actual business model behind it then gets into the next sort of acronym of VPPs or virtual power plants. And that's the other part, is not just stopping at software, but bringing the services towards that so that you can acquire customers, help support the customers to retain them, and then provide that as like a dependable megawatts back to the utilities.
And going back to that point then about getting customers to buy in and persuading customers this is something that is attractive to them and that they want to adopt, what results are you seeing for that then? How is the progress going in terms of educating customers to things, a lot of things that are really very new to people, and saying to people, never mind regulating when people can charge their cars, people just getting used to the idea of charging cars in the first place. That's one step. And then all the extra sophistication that you're talking about, it's a pretty big step, isn't it?
Right, yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, within the energy sector, I say this as an electrical engineer myself, like we bring all of that complexity to the customer and it's not necessary. Like when we think about what is the message that resonates, the words that resonate, the experience that resonates, it's thinking about non-energy related experiences where you're reducing friction or removing friction altogether, such as selling a customer a thermostat that's already incentivized for energy efficiency value, for demand response value, and you're selling them on the convenience that now they can control their temperature automatically or from the comfort of their couch. But the reality is they're also getting an ongoing value proposition to them through bill reduction because it's being dispatched as well.
Because that's another thing that people have been talking about a lot here over the past couple of days, is the political implications of all this. If you're affecting the general public, if you are giving people the perception perhaps that their bills are being pushed up, even if that's not really what's going on, but that's what people will see, that decarbonisation is happening and also the bills are going up, and they'll make that connection. If you're creating what people see as increased inconvenience and telling people when they can and can't use their thermostats, when they can and can't charge their EVs, whatever it might be, then that turns the energy transition into more of a political issue. And that means then that policy is going to change, and policy which has been hugely supportive, very, very supportive under the Biden administration in particular, obviously because of the Inflation Reduction Act, but a lot of other things the administration has been doing in order to try and accelerate deployment of low carbon energy technologies, that could go away, right? And obviously we have an election coming up in this country in November. It's quite possible that control of the Senate will change, control of the White House may change, could end up with a very different political environment and a policy environment 1 year from now. How do you view those kind of changes, and how do you think about, if you're kind of planning your business and you're working with your customers, utilities, obviously trying to make kind of long-term plans, what are your expectations for what a very different policy regime might be like?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Ed. I think one of the great things about the US is that it is a capitalist system, and there is so much diversity across the 50 states and even within the states in that as well. So ultimately, price talks, or the market talks, and so the cost, so going back to the LCOE of renewables before, they are just the more cost-effective solution to go in. And so the market, and even in highly conservative states, are rolling those out, like Texas just being such a leader in the adoption of renewables. But also, they even have smart policies around interconnection, where a solar farm or wind farm can choose to connect and have the risk of curtailment, but they get connection much quicker, bring value much quicker, rather than wait for a really long interconnection study and all that sort of stuff. So even in those areas, you can see the adoption and that sort of continuing otherwise. The same with the consumer technology. While the upside might be slowed a little bit, but the adoption of EVs, because they are fun, enjoyable, comfortable, quiet, affordable vehicles, that continuing through, same with smart thermostats, same with heat pumps and the cost and those sort of things. So I see it more as like the potential might be slowed, but the sort of runaway train that is a lot of this transition or transformation happening, continuing at a speed regardless.
And another issue then, which is sort of related to that, which also people have been talking about here, is the question of equity in the transition. And particularly as it relates to this industry in power, people talk about the ways that tax credits are available. You can get a tax credit if you're putting residential solar in your home. You've got a residential storage system, tax credits if you're buying an EV, and so on, which a lot of people would argue is inequitable, in that obviously the benefits of those tax credits go to the people who are paying more tax and who have higher incomes and can afford to invest in those systems like residential solar. And again, just in political terms, that feels like it's something which is very much kind of rising up the agenda. It's something that people are becoming increasingly concerned about. Do you see that? Do you see that then becoming something that people are more worried about and starting to impinge on your business and among your customers, the utilities?
A good point, Ed. There will definitely be states that are, you know, the incentives that are coming from a federal level, or the incentives that are, or the direction coming from federal level, that'll be undermined if there's a policy change there and that for it. There are definitely those states that are independent of anything federal, like very progressive and pushing around, like, and even cities as well. I think about Sacramento has incentives that are specifically designed at the installation of EV chargers for not just low income, but underserved communities or underserved groups. And so for the general population, it might be $500 they put towards getting a smart charger because it comes with all these other benefits, but the underserved customers can get up to $1,500 towards, and there's means tests around it. And so that uptake in itself is has, you know, within any given week has hundreds of customers in Sacramento's territory applying for these incentives, which is surprising that you would think that these type of the customers are adopting EVs, but the reality is that with the right incentives targeted, that they still can, and that's a municipal doing that.
That is very interesting. And so would you expect that type of program to become more prevalent in the US then?
I think as long as the mechanism to fund, I mean, Sacramento is sort of fortunate because they can stack pieces, you know, across their offering to customers. So there's definitely got to be a motivation and a willingness to do it. But I can see that where, whether it's the utilities or individual states offering programs to help target. And we see that, you know, in other legacy energy efficiency programs and all those sort of things where incentives towards low-income customers, even in conservative states, can still be there.
And then, of course, the other thing in California that was very significant was the change in their net metering rules, which again, that had an equity kind of argument behind it, right? I mean, essentially, the upshot was it made it significantly less attractive to invest in residential solar because you weren't getting rewarded so generously for it. But part of the thinking behind that, presumably, was that, again, the old system as it had previously existed was excessively generous to relatively well-off people who could afford to invest in those systems.
Yeah, I'm sort of torn on this one a little bit too, because, you know, at this point in the time, we need as much renewables as we can get to come on to reach our goals with it. That said though, to the point, setting this mechanism where you're encouraging people to attach batteries to those systems is actually a good thing for the grid, for all customers, and to your point, like avoiding cross-subsidizations with it as well. So I know like in California, like the general solar installation rates have massively dropped, but the percentage of battery attachment rates has gone significantly up, or the number of batteries have continued to roll out at the same rate that they were beforehand. So it's unfortunate from the renewables that we need to be coming online, but it's not undermined the flexibility of those systems that we need ultimately.
Yeah, and actually that is a great point about California and residential storage. I think I saw numbers from Sunrun, you know, the residential solar company, saying that in California in January, 48% of all the systems they sold had storage sold along with it. So, right, yeah, and that's a rate that has shot up in the past couple of years.
In that instance too, you know, for a long time in California, there's been incentives to help with resilience, to help with grid support, and then even having a mechanism to participate into the wholesale market through the demand response auction mechanism. But there's a number of different sort of pieces there that are helping encourage that load flexibility or resiliency or, you know, backup generation element that batteries can bring with the solar pairing too.
And so what difference does this make for your business then as Uplight when you're thinking about working with these utilities, trying to kind of get adoption of your software and systems for managing these distributed energy resources and helping those utilities manage grids with increased flexibility on them? As you say, you're expecting that trend to continue evolving. It's going to keep going in that same direction, but it might be at a slower pace, right? So is that going to mean slower adoption of your technology?
I think the most exciting part of all of it is that in the past, Uplight has really been, a lot of our products were bought through energy efficiency use cases and the adoption of either behavioral or customer engagement or marketplaces to help enable energy efficiency. Over time, that energy efficiency, at least as a percentage in the market and for Uplight, has reduced because of things like electrification and because of things like load flexibility. The sort of needs around both of those last two, the electrification piece, because customers will adopt electric heating or electric transportation regardless, and because the need through the ISOs or through the utilities for increased load flexibility because renewables are just coming on and the grid is becoming more sort of sporadic in its production, that's all kind of continuing on. So I think if anything, the potential there is a challenge to meet, and so it'll continue down that path regardless. And that's, you know, Uplight works in the US primarily, but we also do have programs like in Australia or in India or in France, and in each of those ones has their own sort of characteristics as to what is driving that adoption or that transition. Like in the Australian context, not that much EVs, but so much solar, and the solar is now mostly all gone uncontrolled. So the battery adoption and the need for batteries and that flexibility of the market is really important, particularly as coal power stations shut down as well. So I think all of those trends mean that it just continues, and I particularly think around electrification and load flexibility.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I was saying this the other day, and this has been my kind of lasting impression of being at Distributech, is it's just been fascinating to see the real nuts and bolts of the energy transition actually at work, and to talk to everyone about the technologies that are available, the new technologies that are being developed, the things that our people are starting to deploy. And it's kind of easy often to think about things, I think, in a very kind of abstract way. You know, like I was at COP28 in Dubai back in December, and the kind of the world's policymakers are there and they're talking about decarbonization in this very kind of elevated, high-level way about what the world needs to do and where the world needs to go. And then what you're doing and everyone else in this room is doing, what we're seeing here, is what that actually means in terms of real change on the ground. I find it quite inspiring, I have to say. It's very impressive that, you know, so much work, so much activity, so much capital is being spent, so many brilliant ideas are coming forward to actually change things and make a difference.
Yeah, I think like walking the expo, there is, I imagine 10 years ago at DistribuTech, there would have been so much more switchgear and poles and wires related technology. You walk through here and it's almost like software has eaten the DistribuTech floor, in the sense that there's so much more around flexibility, whether it's flexibility for the utility poles and wires and traditional systems, or flexibility on the customer side. And there's just a number of different technologies, business models, and capabilities that just across the expo floor, I think, which would represent just, you know, the decade bookend of each side, that would show that transformation or give the excitement for what the future holds.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. As you say, it really is a remarkable change. Well, Tom McPhail, thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Thanks so much, Ed. I appreciate the time.
Enjoy the rest of your conference.
Thank you. You too.
And finally for this episode, I talked to my Wood Mackenzie colleagues, Fahema Kazempour and Elam Akavan, about what they'd learned from the event. So it's my pleasure now to be joined by two of my Wood Mackenzie colleagues, Fahema Kazempour, who is our Head of Grid Modernization. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely, pleasure being here.
And also Elham Akavan, who is our Senior Research Analyst for Grid Edge and specialist in microgrids. So you've been spending a couple of days here at DistribuTech, looking around, meeting people, finding out what's going on, and also talking about what we know at Wood Mackenzie about the state of distribution technology and the evolution of the grid in general. What have you learned, do you think? What have you been really struck by, and what have you thought is most interesting? I mean, Fahema, maybe to start with you. So you're saying you've been coming to these DistribuTech conferences for...
That was my fifth time.
Your fifth time.
And
right.
I love it. I keep saying that DistribuTech is like Paris Fashion Week. It sets the color of the year. Each year I'm coming here and I detect, okay, what's going to be the next color? Actually, what's going to be the next buzzword for the next year to come? This year, for sure, it's AI. AI, AI, AI.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been picking up that as well. As you say, everyone wants to talk about AI. What are the aspects of the AI conversation that you found particularly interesting?
Absolutely. So I think that there lots of excitement about different applications of AI. And I think that many of the applications is not really real, new. Some of them have been around for a couple of years, but we weren't really talking about those applications until I think a couple of months ago that ChatGPT became mainstream conversation of houses, of dinner parties, of things like that. And with that application, I think AI, then AGI, it started like becoming mainstream of conversation. And all those solution providers that have been working on AI-related applications, mainly using machine learning models, now all of a sudden I start saying that yes, things that you are talking about, we had a solution around that for many years. So applications that existed before, and now I think this year what I'm seeing at DTech is many new applications that are being developed or are being talked about, or utilities coming to a stage, or even ISOs talking about the fact that they have started using AI.
So to what extent is it just sort of fashionability, as you say, because of ChatGPT, OpenAI, everything they've managed to do, suddenly conversation about AI is everywhere, including at DistribuTech. How much is just that sort of fashionable buzz, and how much is there something really changing, do you think?
Yeah, so Ed, my entire professional career has been on the innovation side of climate tech. I've been around for many years to know that any emerging technology, any innovation of that sort will go through an innovation life cycle. It gets to a point like innovation triggers. It goes through an overhype or hype cycle. It reaches that peak of inflated expectation. It goes down, and it really is up to us as the society working on that to decide whether it comes out of valley of death, gets to a plateau of productivity or not. I believe AI already has applications that are really useful, that are really unique to AI, and really it can transform those part of things. But conversation about, for example, autonomous management of grid using AI, I would put a question mark on if, and if it will happen, then when we will get to that point. So is it a buzzword or not? I think that it will go through this life cycle for sure.
And you put a question mark over that idea about autonomous grid management because what?
There are many challenges that we have to overcome first. For example, I think one thing that I like to talk about is data readiness, data quality for utilities. Even integrating and implementing traditional pieces of software, utilities are struggling with because of the data readiness level. And I think you're familiar with that data set that we have on utility investment in grid modernization. The 50 major IOUs, investor-owned utilities, that are serving 40% of US population, they are investing or they're planning to invest $64 billion in grid modernization. $30 billion of that is going to infrastructure. It's only grid modernization part of infrastructure. And on data side, only 8 IOUs out of those 50 major ones are investing only $300 million to data-related activities, data cleanup, data management platforms, data lakehouse, warehouse, and data lakes. So I think that we have a long road ahead of us. Maybe AI technology is going to be ready sooner than that. But then for us as utilities, as the energy industry, to actually start using this technology and be prepared for that, I think like we have a long road ahead.
That's very interesting. And as we've been saying many times over the past few days as well, that's a great example of the utility industry is inherently conservative. It's inherently risk averse. It is highly regulated. All of those things very much militate against risk-taking, aggressive innovation, radical change. And so I guess, is it inevitable that the industry is going to evolve slowly?
I think if history is teaching us anything is that yes, there will be a slow adoption. But then at the same time, many issues around that AI can actually also provide a solution. One thing that I want to actually like put awareness around is that AI hasn't become mainstream enough for regulators and policymakers to start creating policies around that. I do not know what kind of policies will come into place. I don't know if society starts accepting AI and then the autonomous control, for example, if that's the end vision. If that's the end vision, then regulators and policymakers, how supportive they would be, or would they create policies around that or not? Because technology is only one part of or one leg of this three-legged stool.
Yeah, and it's something people have been pointing out while we've been here in Orlando at DistribuTech talking about technology. There has been simultaneously the Conference of NARUC, North American Regulated Utility Commissioners, so that's all the utility regulators, have been meeting at a separate conference in Washington, D.C. And it's a great kind of symbol of these two parts of the industry just not talking to each other, and regulators aren't finding out about technology, technologists aren't finding out about regulation. It's just two worlds not talking to each other properly, and that does seem like a real problem.
Absolutely. So it's very interesting that you're mentioning that, because the past 2 days, I've met and I've spoken to many folks from DOE, different offices. I've met and I've spoken to many people from ISOs, different ISOs. Utilities, of course, I think that's the place for all utilities to go, but I have not come across a person from regulators. There's a good chance that they might start hiding their badges so no one can notice that they're a regulator. I've been into rooms that they're actually like their hostile conversation about like the role of regulators and why are you barriers and stuff like that. So yeah, but that has been my observation.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. So Ilham, what about you? What have you noticed while you've been here?
Besides what Fahime mentioned on the, definitely AI is the main trend. Everyone is interested in talking, and visibility of the grid is another interesting aspect. But looking into and talking to people from the area that I work on, which is demand and microgrids and behind the meter generation, I am seeing another angle of this trend on AI and data, which is the need of infrastructure for having and providing those data, like data centers that needs to be deployed. And like I'm quoting from one of the people that I talked to, that in the past, the main challenge of data centers was finding a site and location. But right now, the challenge is actually find the power to power up those data centers to be able to transmit and communicate and gather the data and then act based on that. So that's an interesting angle. And that's kind of like cover my area of expertise, working on microgrids as one solution not only, but one of the solutions that trying to address to bring more renewable energy on site, not only address the resilience piece, but also anything that application of renewable energy can offer to a value stack and add. So this is another angle. And to add to that, not only the data center is our challenge, but another part is all of this US activity to bring all of the material, chip manufacturing, raw material, just bring them back from offshore to do and develop everything in-house. So that demand just increased hugely on manufacturing, mining applications, so everything is power to run.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, isn't it? And that is something, as you say, I've also been very struck by, which is expectations about how total demand for electricity is going to grow much more strongly, and probably has already started to grow much more strongly than was the case. I mean, essentially it was flat electricity demand in the US over the past 15 years or so, wasn't it? And just suddenly now really starting to take off. And the joke I've been using, as you say, when you think about AI and data centers and the added load they're putting on the grid, you know, AI is simultaneously the solution to and the cause of the grid's problems.
Yeah, it's kind of a vicious circle
Exactly.
Or chicken and egg issue here.
As you say, yeah, totally chicken and egg. And then you'll hear people, of course, also say, well, therefore, it's also sort of capable of having a chicken and egg solution, which is that we'll have wonderful AI breakthroughs. For instance, I was talking to Zach Cass, who used to work at OpenAI, who was saying what we're going to get is AI helping us to make the breakthrough we need to get to fusion power and large scale, low cost, low waste fusion, etc., all the purported advantages that fusion power would have if we ever got there. And therefore, that'll be the cheap and easy way to provide all the electricity that we need in order to power all the AI that's going to happen because, you know, yeah, go on.
Just want to add something. I mentioned that earlier that everything that we are speaking about, this is the imaginable part of AI. AI has an unimaginable part into that because for innovation to happen, it needs intelligence. So far, we have been limited to human intelligence, but AI is giving us human-level artificial intelligence. So what innovation that intelligence can create, I think we're yet to see. But we saw early signs of that. A couple of weeks ago, AI helped scientists discover a new material for batteries, right? We are yet to see what can happen, but actually this tool can help.
Yeah, no, it's very true. And again, going back to your point about the sort of the hype cycle of technology, clearly there would be people who would have told you with good reason that the internet was overhyped in 1999 and internet stocks were overvalued and turned out to be the case. A lot of them were overvalued and then went on to crash. But the internet has gone on to change society and is continuing to change society in ways that we could not have imagined at the time.
Yeah, I was making this example that the first V2G, like I designed a solution around that and then we deployed that in 2014.
That's vehicle to grid, V2G.
Exactly. So technology was ready in 2014. We did lots of tests and analysis on that. It's still to this very date, V2G is not mainstream solution. Policy, regulatory, financial incentives for grid. Like the challenges that may exist for grid operation if V2G is actually like widely adopted. So there are so many issues around that that needs to get resolved. So the thing is that with AI, it may go much faster, but it will go through the same circle.
Talking about expectation and applications, when it comes to deploying emerging technologies like storage microgrids, we are seeing that a lot of delays happen just because of like commissioning of those microgrids sometimes take a lot of time, like 4 times more than conventional solutions. And when we talk to developers, we learn that this is because a lot of lack of knowledge on testing of these emerging technologies, even permitting of them has some challenges. The utilities has to redo the application just because of not have enough expertise and communication. So one of the application of AI here could be helping to develop and train the workforce and optimum communication and usage of those intelligence to accelerate this process and deploying project faster.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that's definitely another theme I think I've been picking up on over the past couple of days is the sense that the technology is making rapid progress, evolving very quickly. The people are not evolving so fast. You know,
that's true.
Human beings.
And that's the nature of human being, and it needs to be that way. But we are intelligent too, so we can benefit from the technology that we develop to help us optimum our operations.
Yeah, great point. Fehima, I wanted to go back to you. You were saying then, so you started coming to DistribuTech 5 years ago. Well, this is your fifth.
What changes have you noticed in that time? Is this a different event now from what it used to be?
It's different and also at the same time the same. So I think that we didn't have DTA for a couple of years during COVID years, but really the fact that each year there is a buzzword, a couple of those buzzwords are not around anymore. No one talks about them. Remember that life cycle of innovation that I talked to? They stayed and remained in the valley of death. They couldn't survive because they didn't have applications.
So what are those then? What are things that have died off now?
We might get some controversy around that if I actually talk about here, but blockchain is one of them, for example.
Blockchain, it's a good point.
I was at DTech, everyone was talking about blockchain. They were giving up t-shirts with blockchain things on them. And I was like, explain to me, what is this thing? And when they explained, I was like, I don't feel that there are applications for that in the energy industry. And they were saying that if you use it, you can track an apple from warehouse to the customer's house. I was like, why do I want to do that? But anyway, yeah, that was buzzword at least for 2-3 years. Many startups started working in that space. None of them are actually like operational anymore. One point that I want to say on DTech, there are waves of trends that are coming and going, especially because as I'm like, I was a utility before joining Wood Mackenzie, working at the innovation hub of a utility for many years. The thing is that there was a trend, like utilities attend this. They definitely, some of them are very advanced. They attend the panels. And I believe you and I having this conversation before that, I constantly see top 5% utilities in terms of innovation and like expenditure being invited to sit on panels, talk about the emerging technology that they're doing, innovation that they're actually going through. And I keep asking myself that we have 3,000 utilities in the US. How about there is 2,950 other utilities? Who's actually like addressing more their needs? Who's actually talking about the struggles that they have? Are the applications that we are talking about, for example, AI is a very big ticket item of expense for utilities. Others actually can go through that. And now there's this notion of utility as a service. Other utilities that actually succeeding to become that AI-centric future grid can I start actually working with the smaller utilities to help them go through that process. The other trend, which is very interesting to see, is that a couple of years ago, the conversation was that we will be okay with system of systems because we want the best in breed. I'm really happy to see after many years now that trend is kind of like not there anymore.
And so what does that mean? System of systems or what?
Basically, we will be okay with patching someone's ADMS to another provider's OMS, to another provider's GIS, then add another DERMS on top of that, then work with a couple of aggregator DERMS. Now, the theme that I'm seeing this year is convergence. Convergence, it's because I was on the side on utility and I could see what a maintenance nightmare it ends up to. You are responsible and you see yourself being stuck in the middle of he said, she said when you're working with multiple vendors. And now I'm really deeply happy to see that solution providers have found their space. They have become comfortable there in their space, in the main solution that they're offering. And then they have started collaborating and making a strategic partners with others, strategic partnerships with others. And this is, I think, absolutely amazing for the industry as a whole. Now we will start talking that, okay, I'm really good at this space, and I know that I'm not good at the other space, but I don't need to. I can focus on my own space, and I can actually like go through applications through my strategic partner.
So now take a step back then. Everything you've been hearing, talking to people about over the past couple of days, I wonder what it's made you think about the energy transition in general. And what, after all, is the point of so much of this activity, which is decarbonizing the power system and while also meeting increased load, keeping the lights on, providing the electricity that everybody needs at the same time. It often seems to me that when people kind of discuss in kind of general terms the energy transition, you'll sometimes hear people talk about power as being kind of a problem that's been solved. You know, oh, we have renewables and we have maybe nuclear and we have battery storage and we have these technologies and they're all available and they're zero carbon and we can apply those to the power industry and then we can get to zero emissions from power on a foreseeable timescale by the 2030s or whenever it is that people want to be able to do that. you come to DistribuTech and it's immediately clear that it's not actually at all easy. All these thousands of people here are working on this problem, and the more you dig into it, the more problems and challenges emerge. I talked to someone earlier who said it's like peeling an onion, that kind of each time you think you've solved one set of issues, you discover another set that come up. And actually, decarbonizing power in the US and globally is going to take an enormous amount of effort, and it's going to take an enormous amount of innovation and creativity and smart thinking, as well as hard work. When you've been talking to people, and as you've had these conversations over the past couple of days, how has it left you feeling about that effort of decarbonizing and getting to a zero emissions grid? Do you feel more optimistic, less optimistic, about the same? I mean, Fahima, what do you think?
Two words, actually three words, fears and hopes. That's the general theme that I got from DistribuTech and from the audience. Fears for all the challenges that we have ahead of us, from resource adequacy, from renewable energy. Like, many of these solution providers have committed to renewable energy. Some of them actually for 2025. We are talking about 1 year, and that is actually like one of the major data center providers in that space. And then hopes, because this DTEC was around 17,000 people. The smartest of minds were here, like in the past 2 years. If we all can't get it right, then who can? I'm really hopeful, but then I think that, let's be realistic. There are challenges, many challenges, and everyone needs to work together. All different streams actually need to collaborate together for us to get there.
Evelyn, what do you think?
I'm optimistic generally, but when we are talking about renewable energy and power system, the elements of challenge that we are tackling here and all the brains we put together to solve it, we inherited a grid, we inherited a big system that has more than 100 years. And I'm not talking about the aging of the infrastructure, I'm talking about the concept of the power grid, which we inherited 100 years ago. And it's a big transmission lines, power plants, all the way to customers. And now we are trying to add all of these new and emerging, fast, evolving technology on a system that is so large, giant, and so old concept. So merging all of this together is a really, really big challenge. And that's why I respect to all of these trial and errors that I'm seeing happening in this space, that coming, everyone rely on that or try to pilot and then get the on the field testing and then go out and then the next one evolve and the better one come. Generally, I'm optimistic. We are a little bit beyond the schedules of everything, like the mismatch between the growth of the load versus the permitting process, the resource adequacy, the fame and touch on that. So all of these pieces bring fears for sure, but I'm seeing, at least in my space, I'm seeing a, like, accelerated announcements, more like people that try to kind of sit together, try to understand. We are seeing like regulators that are slowly but gradually helping utilities also. So I think everyone is just gradually understand the accelerated needs and to need to act too fast on that. So I try to be optimistic.
Excellent. That's good. I'm very pleased to hear that. As I say, I think my sense, I would agree with both of you really, which is you've got to have to be realistic about the challenges, but also it's tremendously impressive the amount of brain power that's being dedicated to this problem. And as you say, there is real progress being made, definite steps forward. There's so much going on, and that has to make you feel reasonably optimistic, cautiously optimistic maybe, about the future.
I think we are following Edison that at the end he said that I try multiple approaches, none of them go to the electricity, but I learned multiple roads that don't go there, but then eventually I think we are kind of like continue on that path and we will get there.
One thing that I want to add is that many of folks that I met or I work with or I know in my network, we all have very young children at home. And for us, it's no longer an option. The thing is that, for example, I have a five-year-old. She may live to see the day that the temperature has risen by 2.5 degrees Celsius. What kind of earth am I leaving for her? Like, for me, it's out of option, out of question that we need to do something. Is it going to be expensive? Of course. But should we do it? Of course. like we have One Earth, even if it's expensive, if it means that like cutting some other expenses and pay for this transition, I want that to happen.
Yeah, no, that is a great point. And I do think that's a really important perspective to have. Fahima, Ilham, thank you both very much for joining me on the Energy Gang today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And that's all from us from DistribuTech. Many thanks for Fahima Kazempour and Ilham Akhavan for joining the Energy Gang this time. Thanks also to Don McPhail of Uplight and Ellie Apache of AATI and everyone else who talked to us while we've been here. Many thanks to our producers, Dan Cotter and Sam Nash. And above all, many thanks to all of you for listening. Please do keep your feedback coming. As you know, we're always keen to hear your views. And we'll be back soon with all the latest news and views on the energy transition. Until then, goodbye.